All right, I'm your host, James Gillen. We've got another awesome show. We've got Brandon Adams back, and we're going to talk a lot about sovereignty, freedom, and a few other subjects. But I'm going to turn this mic over to Nate and have Nate start the show, and then we're going to just free flow from there.
Okay. And well, Brandon, thanks for joining us and sharing your time with us today. We really appreciate that. First, maybe we could just give a little background, because we do have kind of a diverse audience that listens to this program, and maybe not everybody that listens to this program is well-versed in contract law or commerce, or any of these other various subjects that fall into that rabbit hole. So, you know, could you maybe just briefly give a synopsis of who you are and what you do, Brandon?
Maybe I can give an illustration of the foundation of government law and contract so that people kind of understand their place and their role and how, and the power and control that they have over their lives.
Yeah, precisely.
What's that?
Precisely. Yeah, great.
Yeah. So basically, if you look at, well, people are familiar with the structure of corporations, right? So corporations are usually something that you establish for the purpose of doing business and limiting the liability to that entity's name, okay? So, for instance, I can start a company called ABC Inc., and ABC Inc. is in the business of selling widgets and gadgets, and if one of those widgets or gadgets damages or hurts someone, the claim that that person would have would be against ABC Inc. ABC Inc. serves as kind of a barrier limiting the liability between the owners of the corporation and the consumers or the clients of the corporation. Now, our governments, all governments, are pretty much set up the same way. So, if you imagine the United States as a corporation, okay, which it basically is, it has within it members, subjects, employees, so to speak. So U.S. citizens are entities authorized under that entity. So just like I need to go to the Secretary of State of California in order to get the authority to create a corporation that operates under the laws of the state of California, a individual that wants to benefit or enjoy the benefits and privileges of U.S. citizenship needs to go and establish an entity in the United States through which its liability and business is conducted, okay? So many people refer to this entity as a straw man. It's basically a corporation that is authorized to exist under the United States. It is not you. It is just an entity through which you engage in business within the United States. Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to, like, let's say, this audience, I imagine, may be familiar with suppressed technologies, mm-hmm. sort of like free energy or anti-gravity or mm-hmm. things like that, which are technologies that exist that are suppressed for commercial purposes. Now, they're suppressed within the corporation known as the United States, okay? Within the corporation of the United States, all entities who derive their authority inside that entity all exist within that one corporation. So just like ABC Inc. that sells widgets and gadgets has several roles, it has a CEO, it has a CFO, and it has vice presidents and employees, the United States is set up the same way. Whereas ABC Inc. may have a subdivision known as research and development. It may have a subdivision known as its sales team, and it may have a subdivision for marketing, and it may have a subdivision for accounting. The United States Corporation subdivides itself the same way. It calls these subdivisions departments and agencies. Mm-hmm. So this corporation regulates how all of its members interact, just like ABC Inc. ABC Inc., when it was established, had a set of bylaws. And those bylaws dictate how and in what capacity the individual members of ABC Inc. can engage with each other, or how they can engage with their clientele or their vendors or anything else. So U.S. Inc. established its bylaws, and those bylaws come in the form of U.S. code and other forms of code that are instituted at the state, city, county levels. And so each political subdivision, whether we're talking the state of California, the county of Los Angeles, the city of Monterey, these are all political subdivisions. They're like departments within the corporation, and they have their own bylaws, and they have their own employees, and they have their own subjects within them. So if we wanted to use or put into use technologies that are suppressed within the corporation known as USA Inc., we can establish through contract outside of USA Inc. Because remember, we as living beings are not actually part of USA Inc. The part of our engagement, our interaction with USA Inc. is facilitated through an entity. Okay? And that entity is for contracting purposes within USA Inc. Now, if I wanted to contract with you on a private basis, meaning without USA Inc. as a part of our contract, that means we no longer have the benefits and privileges that U.S. citizens that are within USA Inc. have. For instance, if you and I decide to enter into a private contract, and we expressly enter into this contract without the United States, and we expressly waive any limited liability protections or rights of USA Inc., i.e., the right to use their judicial system if we have a conflict within our contract, we can basically, the terms of our contract of performance are only dictated by the contract between us. Whereas if I'm engaging as a U.S. citizen with another U.S. citizen and enjoying the protections, consumer protections, civil rights, and things like that, then I'm actually under and regulated by the bylaws of that corporation because I'm acting as an employee or as a subject of that corporation.
Uh-huh. Now that's an important distinction to make here, Brandon, because a lot of people might just assume that, you know, you live here in the USA, you're a citizen. So, you know, are we all citizens because we live here, or, you know, have we been groomed to be citizens? Can you go in a little bit more on that?
First of all, you have to be able to define the difference or make distinctions of the different United States that exist, okay? Typically, when people hear the words together, United States, it conjures up an image for them of what that means. Now, I would say the most common image that's conjured up is it is all of the states together, the territory that when you look on the map, you see this border that kind of forms the shape of a turtle, and we call it the United States. But that's not the United States I've been referring to. The United States I've been referring to is a federal corporation, okay? It's also the U.S. government does business as the United States, and that's an entity. It's a corporation. So it's not territory or land, okay? Now, it may extend a jurisdiction, okay, but jurisdiction depends on the parties and the nature of the contracting. So, for instance, you've heard of diplomatic immunities, mm-hmm. and how different foreign consulates have offices or buildings here within what you think of as the United States, in the territory, in the land known as the United States. Yet, the laws of the United States do not apply on their property, right? Because they're literally a little bubble of their own nation, meaning the only laws that apply within that bubble are the laws of that foreign nation, not the laws of the United States. And so any contracting that they do is done under international law. It's not done as because they're not subjects of the United States. They're not exercising benefits and privileges of citizens within the United States. They are not, they're contracting in a different jurisdiction, okay? Mm-hmm. So we have the distinction of the territory, the land that we commonly refer to as the United States. That is not the same thing as the United States, a federal corporation that does business with other federal or national corporations under the guise of national sovereignty. So there's different types of citizenship based on those distinctions, okay? When the United States was first established as a society, each state being sovereign. Each state being sovereign as a result of the people within that state being sovereign and choosing to establish among them a state, okay? So when you consider that being born within the territory, not the jurisdiction, but being born within a certain territory, you are recognized to have certain rights as a citizen of the many states, okay? So realistically, because the original structure of this nation was each state was an individual, an independent nation, and these states formed together under the Constitution to engage in basically in commerce in such a way that they would protect, they would pool their resources to protect their borders, and they would pool their resources for the purposes of different trade regulations between the states, okay? So there's a citizenship that is innate by your birth in the territory, but that's not what a U.S. citizen is. A U.S. citizen is a special entity that was defined under the 14th Amendment, okay? Mm-hmm. And a U.S. citizen is basically a special class of a special class for individuals within the United States. So it's taking that federal corporation and saying that within the federal corporation there's a special class of individuals known as U.S. citizens, and they enjoy benefits and privileges within that. So it's almost like, again, we go back to ABC Inc., and in ABC Inc., I have employees, and my employees have certain benefits and privileges that they enjoy as a part of being an employee of ABC Inc. So a U.S. citizen is like choosing to be an employee of USA Inc., okay, whereas sovereignty or citizenship by your innate, by being born into a territory is distinctly different. So if we're looking from the context of the U.S. corporation, and we're making the distinction of someone born free in a territory who has not necessarily chosen that special designation or privilege of U.S. citizenship, from the USA Inc. standpoint, this individual would be a state national, okay, under their definitions, how they would look out at you. So rather than being a U.S. citizen, you would be a California national, okay? Now, once you choose the special benefit and privilege of being a U.S. citizen, it's not that you've given up that status as California national, because what you do when you become or when you choose U.S. citizenship, you're choosing to authorize an entity that you're going to take responsibility for that does business within the United States. And again, this is something people refer to as the straw man. Mm-hmm. It's a fiction of law, a procedural phantom, so to speak, that is the U.S. citizen. And it enjoys benefits and privileges of the U.S. corporation. Mm-hmm. So there's two very distinct different things when it comes to quote unquote citizenship. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now you're talking a lot about benefits and privileges and rights. So people might think, what's the difference between benefits and privileges versus, you know, rights and our duties?
Okay, well, rights, every man and woman is born with unalienable rights. These are rights that are talked about in the Declaration of Independence and great documents like this. Now, the one thing I want to get through to people is that nobody granted you those rights. Okay, so like this is one of the things that I try so hard to get through to people, because a lot of people want to point to the Constitution and their constitutional rights. Okay, you were born with rights. You were born as a product of the infinite, as a child of God. You have these unalienable rights. And one of your unalienable rights is to contract. Okay? So, and if you look at, like, even the Declaration of Independence, not as a document of authority that granted you those rights, but how they articulate those rights. They articulate them as the right to the freedoms, right? The freedom of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Which they've translated to mean the right to exchange and to hold property, okay? So these are unalienable rights. You were born with these. The Declaration of Independence didn't give them to you. The Constitution didn't give them to you. Nobody gave you those rights. Nobody appointed those rights to you. In fact, you're not a party to the Constitution. The states were parties to the Constitution. The Bill of Rights was never intended to be something like, oh, we as the government are granting you these rights. No, no. The Bill of Rights was meant to be something that limited the government, that so that people would recognize that the government was never established or intended to have power over the people. That the government itself is a result of the people, that the people granted their power to the government. Okay, so the government is subservient to the people. Okay, so there are no rights granted to you by the government. You were born with all the best rights. Okay, now, when you talk about operating within the corporation as a U.S. citizen, you no longer have the unalienable rights because you've waived them. You entered into a contract.
By
the
being
contract
a citizen?
Is the only thing that can restrict or limit your rights by your consent.
A social security card.
What's that?
Would that be like the social security card, the number? That, or is there more to that?
Well, that's one facet of your U.S. citizenship, but there were many declarations in many different registrations that you declare yourself to be a U.S. citizen. For instance, your driver's license application. If you have a driver's license, meaning you're getting licensed by the state to engage in a commercial activity known as driving, okay, they're going to have a question on there about being a U.S. citizen. And if you mark it yes, you're making an election to being a U.S. citizen. When you get Social Security, when you fill out the SS-5 Social Security application, you're doing the same thing. You're saying, yes, I want the benefits and privileges of a U.S. citizen. Okay? Uh-huh. Sometimes, and I'm sure that even nowadays, I'm sure the birth certificates probably have some kind of election of being a U.S. citizen. I've seen them on passport applications. They have an election for you to choose to mark yourself as a U.S. citizen. So there's many different contracts in play that you've made an election to operating as a U.S. citizen. So notice the choice of words I use there. Operate as. Mm-hmm. As means in the capacity of a U.S. citizen. You are not a U.S. citizen, but you can choose to operate as a U.S. citizen.
So, Brandon, these contracts limit your, you've
consented to waiving your inalienable rights in many of these contracts.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that, you know, for a lot of people that never realized that, they just thought they were a citizen, they thought, oh, that's the correct thing for me to fill out when I fill this form out. And, you know, and then later they become aware of this and think, oh, well, I didn't have to do that. Is there any going back? Just because you said that you're a citizen doesn't mean that you're always operating in that capacity.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because you choose to operate in that capacity or you choose not to. So you're not in any way bound to it because what you have to consider is that entity exists by virtue of you electing U.S. citizenship. So that entity exists on the driver's license. That entity exists on a bank account. That entity exists on a passport. So to divorce yourself from that entity, you would have to stop using it in all its capacities, meaning bank accounts, driver's licenses, passports, all these items that designate you U.S. citizen or that you get benefits and privileges or the receipt of any benefits and privileges. So, for instance, unemployment or Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. These are all benefits and privileges that employees of USA Inc. have. Okay, so let's go back to the model ABC Inc. If I'm not an employee of ABC Inc., I don't get to share in their retirement fund. I must be a member of ABC Inc. I must be an employee in order to benefit from the retirement fund. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to benefit from Social Security, which is a benefit and privilege offered to U.S. citizens by USA Inc., well, then your entity is in that contract, mm-hmm. okay? So, and you are the one who's responsible for that entity in commerce. Just like if I'm the share of all the board of directors and the executive team of any corporation take on the responsibility of operating that entity. Well, you've chosen to take on the responsibility of operating the U.S. citizen. So all the bank accounts, all the property that you register under that entity, you're responsible for. Hmm. So it's really, we'd have to look at completely unwinding all these contracts we've gotten ourselves into. And then when you talk about benefits and privileges could include the use of Federal Reserve notes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, literally to operate outside of that USA Inc. so that we're not restricted by the regulations put on members of USA Inc. We would have to completely stop using those entities. Those straw men, those corporations,
mm-hmm.
we would have to start to interact and engage with each other outside of those entities. So again, if I wanted to, let's say, go around and install for people free energy devices for their house so that they know, so that they could unplug from the grid and that they could receive energy for free. One, I could not advertise this service or this product in the public because the public is commerce within the United States, and commerce within the United States is regulated by the United States. That is the power we gave government. When we created government, we gave it the one, this is the one power we gave it. The one power we gave it was to regulate commerce in and amongst the members of that society. So as this republic transformed into a democracy and a federal corporation, the benefits and privileges that this federal corporation offers are what we either are part of its regulation of commerce. So it's going to regulate commerce such to not only preserve its own existence, but to preserve a status quo, so to speak. You guys ever seen the movie, is it Tucker? The guy who built the car?
Oh, yeah, yeah, they squeezed him out.
Right, and the reason, the justification for getting rid of Tucker was his car was so revolutionary that it would have put all the other car companies out of business. And so the government, with its power of regulating commerce and maintaining the status quo, can shut him down. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with free energy. See, energy is the biggest business there is. There isn't more money earned doing anything else other than pimping energy. It's a trillion-dollar industry.
Mm-hmm.
So when you consider that energy can be produced for free, how much revenue would be taken out of the public commercial system as a result of that? So they take it upon themselves. Remember, they must preserve, for one, their own existence. So the government must preserve its own existence, and it must preserve the commercial status quo. So free energy is a no-no. Okay. Now, the only thing they can regulate is commerce within their corporation. ABC Inc. cannot go tell AT&T employees what to do because AT&T employees operate under their own bylaws. And ABC Inc.'s bylaws have no applicability to AT&T employees. So when we decide to step outside of the United States, and I don't mean the territory, but when we decide to operate without the benefits and privileges of their judicial system, without the benefits and privileges of their limited liability protections between us as we do business, then we can do things like free energy. We can build free energy devices because, one, we're not advertising it in their commercial system. We're not using public commerce or threatening public commerce. Two, we are doing it without their banking system. We're not using their banking system. We're not using their bank notes. We're not using their credit system. We would be exchanging on whatever system of exchange we decided as individuals in private contracts. So if I decide I'm going to build free energy devices for people and take them off the grid, then one of the considerations I have to take that I have to be aware of is for one, the property itself is entwined in contracts within the United States. Okay? the individual who's living on the property is entwined in contract with the United States. So I would have to expressly, in my contract, make all these waivers and all of the necessary terms and conditions to expressly exclude the United States, including what am I accepting in exchange? I may charge you instead of charging you Federal Reserve notes or accepting checks or credit cards. I would have to maybe charge you, let's say, 20 ounces of silver. So for 20 ounces of 9.99% pure silver, I'm going to build a device that powers your home. Now, because of the contract that your home is in, there may be some other intricacies that you need to address. Now, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, off the grid, or you're running on, let's say, a gas generator, and you know, somebody comes up to your property and brings propane, so you're not really on a grid, so to speak. There's a lot less to untwine there. There's a lot less contracts to deal with in order to get free energy. Whereas if you live in a track, you know, a housing track where everybody's got plumbing and everyone's got electricity and everyone's got, you know, cable and everything else running to their house, and you're all sharing these public resources, that's going to be a very tricky situation to literally taking your house out of all the contracts it's involved in so that you can take it off the grid. Okay? But what I'm proposing is that we start to operate in a parallel society, meaning we start to not only inform people that we can enter into contracts without the United States, but that we actually do it, and that we exchange valuable consideration like gold or silver or anything else, whatever you choose as your valuable consideration. But we start to learn how not to use those entities that they regulate. Mm-hmm. And we learn how to operate in private contracts so that we can start to build these things, and we can start to really build a sustainable world, you know, because right now the system that we put into place, remember that it's not like there is no one else responsible, there is no one to blame, there's no one to point the finger at other than us. This is what we created. Okay? Yeah. And we created it to be something that we benefit from. Okay? And because it's a monetary system, there's diminishing returns in this system. Literally, technology has evolved to such an extreme point that our actual commercial system must become extremely inefficient and ineffective for it to continue to operate. Meaning, all of these sustainable elements must be done away with. Light bulbs last 6 months. Okay, we got to make light bulbs only last 3 months. Cars last 5 years. Okay, we got to start building cars that only last 1 year. You see, that's the trend. That's where we're going towards, because as technology's evolved to such an advanced point, we can't really bring all these advanced technologies in because it would make obsolete our entire consumer system. And the consumer system is based on we must continually consume. So that means we can't build quality clothing that lasts for years on end. We can't build quality machinery that lasts forever. We can't use free energy. We can't use sustainable methodologies, because these things take consumerism out of the equation. So literally, we need to reform our own society where consumerism and consuming and unsustainability is not the essential core of or foundation of the society. And that's where we're at right now. Our society is going to continue to get more and more ineffective, less and less efficient, because we must keep the consumer rate going. Whereas if we chose as individuals, and this is, I mean, we live in a beautiful time. This is the most amazing time to exist on this planet. We have the capacity to communicate with every single person on the planet instantaneously. And because we have the power to communicate with every single individual on the planet instantaneously, we, the people, can come together and choose a different foundation for society. We can say what we want is a system that is sustainable. What we want is a system that promotes longevity. You know, our current system promotes obsolescence. That's why we can build light bulbs that last forever, but we don't sell them. They're suppressed because anything that lasts forever takes the consumption element out of the equation. We could build cars that last for 50, 60 years. In fact, we used to. You ever notice that a car from the 40s or 50s has maintained much better than a car from the 80s?
Yeah.
Like, you could take a car from the 80s and a car from the 50s, put them side by side, and the car from the 50s is in much better condition.
Yeah.
Because as time's gone on, we've had to make vehicles less and less efficient. We've had to literally, because we need people to consume more in that old model. Mm-hmm. But what if we adopted a new model and we started running this model parallel to the old model? Because again, we don't need to fight anything. We don't need to blame anyone, but we can invent something new that operates completely differently. Mm-hmm. And because we have the power to communicate, we can align the people of the planet behind a new model. You know, rather than operating in a model that necessitates obsolescence and consumption, we say, you know what? We want to create an infrastructure. We want to create for ourselves government, but government for the purpose of running society, not government for the purpose of dictating opinions. We're going to leave politics out of government. Government is now just a function of our communities operating. Now, what do we consider the values of an operational community? Okay, well, our government is only going to be tasked with providing us with clean water, okay? No fluoride, no chlorine, clean water. Okay, what else do we want from our government? We want free energy. Okay, we create this government. We provide free energy. We start to create clean water distribution systems. And we make that the foundation of government. Now we look at, and let's, if we still want to use money, because I know that the idea of leaving monetarism is really difficult for people to conceive of. Well, how do you do that? Because people only see, they see monetarism as a necessity, that if you don't have money, then people won't work and people won't do stuff. And if people don't do stuff, society's going to deteriorate and fall apart. Okay. Let's say instead of if we're going to continue to use a monetary system, let's rearrange the values of how a monetary system operates. So, I mentioned last time that city in Canada that did the guaranteed income thing?
Yeah, I've heard about that. That was amazing. Everybody totally flourished.
Yeah, they totally flourished. And the ideas, the concepts that people had of, well, people won't work. No, people still worked because you were guaranteed a minimum income, right? But you could still go out and work. What they found was, people were only doing things they loved doing, that they wanted to do. The work no longer became a necessity. It became a
service.
Something that they could, not only contribute, but so that they could also, I don't want to use the word benefit, but that they can receive the value of performing that. So like, if you have a love for doing something in particular, then your contribution to society is also a gift for yourself because you enjoy that type of contribution. Okay, So you find that people will do things that they love doing. Now, because we've tasked our government with providing the necessities, meaning we value shelter, we value food, and we value good organic, nourishing food, and we value shelter and, you know, things like this, we now task government with creating those things. But that's all government's for.
Jesus.
And that we recognize that the most valuable thing in society are the people. So every individual in the society is the most, we recognize that since these are the highest, the most valuable things we have, our society, our monetary system is going to get, have a guaranteed amount that gets distributed to each individual, and that guaranteed amount will cover all costs of food, all costs for transportation, all costs for shelter, all the necessities. Okay, now, if you want to excel, you can still get engaged in business. However, we also determine that there are certain values that we hold for our businesses. And because no one has to work and everyone has the necessities, and now we're using things like free energy and sustainable methodologies, we are now no longer are we looking to make money through obsolescence. So if I'm a textile manufacturer, I manufacture clothing. Because of the values of our society being one of sustainability, I'm going to be manufacturing clothing that lasts the longest. What materials am I going to use so that the clothing that I manufacture lasts longer, not less time? You know, and what, as a automobile manufacturer, what elements am I going to build into my automobile so that they last longer? So now our focus is no longer obsolescence. We're not trying to get you to consume. We're trying to build up the value of things so that we have a sustainable society. Because as a society, we've decided we want sustainability. We don't want to rape the planet of all its resources and kill it. Mm-hmm. Okay, we decide as a people that that's not a functional model. Mm-hmm. So this is where why I think an understanding of how to operate in private contract is going to be where we the people can step into what's next. Even though the system that's in place is going to kick and scream and die a violent death because it necessitates scarcity. It necessitates consumption. It necessitates ineffectiveness and inefficiency. So that system, because it's also, it's a survivalist. Everything has a survival instinct, even fictions like democratic federal corporations or AT&T. These corporations, these entities are naturally, they naturally want to maintain their existence. So if we create this parallel system, it'll just suffocate that other system so that other system just kind of withers away and dies. But we don't have to destroy it. We don't have to rebuild it. We can build something parallel to it, especially when we start to learn how to leave it out of the transaction. If tomorrow everyone decided that they were no longer going to use bank accounts and Federal Reserve notes and they were going to use private exchange and private valuable exchange and all their contracts are going to be written so that the United States was not a part of the contract, that everyone put into their contracts private arbitration clauses so that if they do get into some kind of dispute in the contract, they're not litigating over. They're not using the benefits and privileges of the public judicial system. Could you imagine empty courts where we, because we've taken responsibility for our conduct and our contracts and our performance, we privately settle all of our problems? Literally, that system would just melt away because, for one, as the scale of this little endeavor moves up, there's no purpose for anyone to stay with the old system if everyone's moving into the new system of valuable exchange. So it's not like we have to overthrow anything. It's not like we have to destroy anything. We just have to invent something new that we can run parallel to, because there are no restrictions. We have the unalienable right of contract. We can choose to contract in any way, shape, or form we see fit.
Yeah, I think you're right, Brandon. Like, if more and more people understood and had these tools, you know, the practical application of these tools of utilizing contract, that would be a major game changer for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's one of the reasons we've been really excited to, you know, to start to branch out and network with folks that have, you know, a greater understanding of this sort of information, like yourself and others, and bringing them on the show, because, yeah, it just seems like this sort of stuff is kind of a real missing piece in the alternative, you know, information community that I think so many people can benefit from.
Oh, absolutely, because all the things that people want to complain about are, we can completely resolve through mm-hmm. private contract. Like, one of the things that that you may be familiar with that I'm bringing up because of what I believe the nature mm-hmm. of your show and your mission is like disclosure. You know, you've heard of like the Disclosure Project, right?
Sure. Uh-huh.
And people want to be upset and angry that there isn't disclosure from the government, or that the mainstream media does not give you certain information. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's choose our own sources of media.
Totally.
Let's choose to take away that power that we've given a group of, what, five companies? There are five companies that run the world's media. They publish all the books. They publish all the magazines. They make all the movies. They make all the TV shows. They make available all the music. What if we stopped going to these five companies for our information? Imagine. It's not like there's no other resources available, but it's, again, we start suffocating that system. We stop using it. We leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
We realize that, okay, mainstream media has very limited value, because all that mainstream media is structured for is for maintaining the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And the status quo is leading us down this trail of being less and less effective, less and less efficient, more and more obsolescent. So if we don't want that model, we have to literally leave major media out of the equation. Let's go to alternative media. And again, we're in a unique time in history where we could communicate information with everyone in the world for very low cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagine, I would say that the first order of business is establishing a free network of information transmission. You know, the internet right now has a framework, a foundation, you know, that the communication companies have a hold on. But in our society, if we choose that things like information and energy are free, then we need to put into place infrastructure that will supply the transmission of information and electricity for free. So that's one of the first things we have to do. But we can organize an entire community around that idea because we have the internet available to us now. You know, because we have these resources now, we can start to implement and start to put into effect global energy transmission and global information transmission systems.
Mm-hmm. So, Brandon, yeah, there's a couple of things I've been hearing you say over and over again, and I'm familiar with your work, so I've heard you say, you know, some of these concepts in, you know, some of your audios that are on the CIC site. But, you know, there's so many hidden truths that more and more people are becoming aware of. And you've been talking a lot about, like, free energy, or, you know, we're talking about UFOs or hidden medical cures, alternative history, or, you know, the quantum nature of consciousness and so forth, healing with energy and intention. And then there's other things that people are becoming more and more aware of, like the actual nature of money and fractional reserve lending and, you know, all the what we might consider the corruption and conspiracy. And a lot of this that we might, this info we might come to as we're becoming more and more aware of what's been suppressed, we might consider it like kind of a dark revealing of some of the dark stuff that's going on, you know? And so it seems like a real natural reaction as we go through this journey of awareness, of becoming aware of that sort of stuff, is to, you know, to go into fear about it, or to have the reaction to blame it on, you know, on all these external forces. And certainly from one perspective, you know, we can see that some of the challenges that humanity is facing, we might not necessarily have direct physical control over at this moment. So, you know, can you go a little bit more into your perspective on, you know, facing the challenges humanity is chasing, facing, but not blaming, and instead taking responsibility, or using the language that you often use, being a creditor or being a creator?
Well, in that context, we first have to recognize that any darkness that we perceive of the world is our own dark side. Like you said, there's this tendency to go to fear, okay? So all that reflects back at us in the darkness is a dark side of ourselves. You know, I think it was Gandhi who said, you know, to, you know, change the world, you start with changing yourself. You know, if you want to change the outside world, you reflect, you look within. And what is it about me that is reflecting in society and societal greed? You know, because it's really greed is driving this obsolete system. So what is greed? Greed comes from fear. And fear of what? Fear of lack, fear of not having, fear of there not being enough. And now, really, for the last 100 years, we've been in a place in technology where the fear of not having enough, we have the capacity to overcome that. We have the capacity to ensure everyone has enough. But the fear of not having enough keeps us trapped in using the old system, in continuing the facade, and continuing engaging it and interacting with it and feeding it our energy. It only exists because we feed it. If tomorrow everyone decided we're no longer going to use this public system of commerce and exchange, it would die instantly because we feed it. We keep it alive. So we have to realize that we are 100% responsible for what the world is experiencing. That there, it is our own fear that keeps energy companies in control. It is our own fear that keeps money lenders in control. If we decided tomorrow we were no longer going to use their money system and we were going to create our own, and we got a consensus, which we can come to because we have a global communication system, then we could completely transform our commercial system. And we could completely transform our lives and our world.
Mm-hmm. So, now, Brandon, there's another concept that you talk a lot about, and it's the come from. Where are we coming from, you know, in life, in any endeavor, in perhaps an endeavor where we're trying to achieve a remedy, a commercial remedy, or maybe it's just a remedy with, you know, some of the people in our lives that we have interpersonal dynamics, you know, with. So could you expand a little bit on the concept of the come from?
Yeah, come from is basically a simple way of expressing our ways of being. And our ways of being are a direct result of how things occur to us. Meaning, if the current world situation, whether it's the energy situation, the health situation, if those things occur to us, as threatening, okay? If those things occur to us as unjust, if then our way of being in a threatening situation is what dominates our behavior. It's what dominates our actions. It's what dominates our thoughts. Now, if rather than it occurring to us as something threatening or something to worry about or anything like that, if we start to see the situation, the circumstances of the world as an opportunity, you know, rather than projecting on it, it's a threat, we project on it, it's an opportunity to excel. It's an opportunity to overcome. It's an opportunity to do it better than we've done it. Then our come from, our way of being is transformed because we face opportunities in a much different way than we face a threat or we face a controversy. You know, if we see government as the enemy, if we see corporations as the bad guys, then our way of being as it is dictated by that, how that occurs to us. Whereas if we see the current situation as this is an opportunity, you know, then we can start to come from a different place. We can start to come from a place of peace and compassion and love and contribution and collaboration and integrity and commitment. And so we start to rearrange the way, and because that things are now occurring to us differently, which meaning we've cleaned the lens that we interpret the world through, because that's how things occur to you, is through this lens. So if your lens is fogged, then the lens, and you perceive the world around you as a threat, or you perceive the world around you as unjust, or you perceive the world around you as dangerous, or any of those things, then your way of being is going to dictate your thoughts, your actions, and your words as if they are a threat, as if they are a danger. Rearranging the lens, polishing the lens, cleaning it off so that we see things objectively and we choose to have them occur to us as opportunities. Then we start to engage and cooperate and collaborate with each other in a different way. And that different way of being, that different come from is one of invention. It's one of creativity. When you're coming from a place of love, appreciation, and joy, you're in a state for creativity, for invention. Whereas when you're coming from a place of fear, hatred, and worry, then you're really coming from a place of destruction, of conflict. Okay? So that's the main thing that I try to get through to people, is that you're either perceiving the world through a lens of it's all a conflict, it's all a threat, or you're going to perceive it through the lens of it's an opportunity. And you're going to love and appreciate and have compassion for everything, because there is nothing to point the finger at. There is no one to blame. That the only conflict is the conflict that I project. And because if I project conflict, then I will act as if it's conflict. I will think as if it's conflict, and my results will be conflict.
Yeah, man.
I have a question for you, just to be a little bit of the devil's advocate here. I used to say that, we've created all these positions and given our power to these positions, and almost everything comes from giving our power away outside of ourselves to these other positions, and people snatching those positions up and betraying a trust or using that power against us. And I always say, if I die tomorrow, is all this going to end? You know, and so am I creating all of this, or is this Does this have a momentum of its own, you know, through the collective consciousness or through people who are uneducated, whatever, or the tyranny, you know, is it going to continue whether or not I'm here? And my conclusion is what I've come to is I agree, we have to stand tall and greet things as an opportunity and not get into fear. But at the same time, we need to acknowledge that there are these people out there that have agendas, and their agendas are to enslave the masses, and you know, they have a sense of entitlement, and they want to continue business as usual on this downward spiral, you know, which they're on. And as we spoke about before, everything, the way things are set up now, you know, you have, as long as you've got the war industry as one of the major corporations, you know, you're not going to have peace. As long as you have the pharmaceutical industries in charge of our health and well-being, who capitalize on disease, the cures aren't going to be coming forward, you know. And as long as you have the oil industries in office at the highest positions, we're going to have real trouble getting free energy out. You know, and I look at the system that we have set up now, and just to point out the way it is now, you know, it's kind of weird. I have this thing of it. Before I used to take, okay, I created all this, I'm taking responsibility for all of it. But now I'm realizing that, wait a second, whether or not I'm here or not, this is going to continue. But am I going to be part of the solution or part of the problem? Am I going to figure out ways to address this situation, stand tall, and create a different society as you're doing and you're creating? And it's a different approach. I've always been kind of on the fence on that, on total responsibility for creating all of it versus does this have a life of its own? And you know, with 7 million lemmings running off a cliff, you know, it has a forward momentum of its own, you know, and we're just going to do the best we can to divert that forward momentum.
Yeah, but in reality, all of its forward momentum is us. Like you talk about an agenda that someone has of enslaving the masses. That's not their agenda. That's no one's agenda. People's agenda, it's exactly the same agenda that you have. It's self-preservation. Their level of fear is at a much different level than your level of fear. See, some people fear not having $1,000 in the bank account. If they don't have at least $1,000 in their savings, then they feel threatened. They feel lack. They feel limitation. Some people feel fully comfortable going check to check, where they never have anything in the savings, but they seem to make it from month to month. So their savings account does not dictate their feeling of lack, limitation, and scarcity. So you're talking about there are people who operate within certain roles and certain positions who have no more concern than anyone else other than their self-preservation. So everyone has this sense of self-preservation and what that equates to and what that looks like for each individual is different. So certain people like, let's say maybe George Bush. George Bush's fear of lack and limitation might be not having $1 trillion. You know, that if he doesn't have $1 trillion and thousands of acres of land and resources for himself, that feels to him like a threatening situation, then what you're going to see is him acting in a way to preserve himself, to preserve his ideology, which is all you're going to see in anyone. So again, the dark side you see of any of these people who serve in these roles or positions is a reflection. We have fear, and they have fear. And so we can't chastise people for acting from fear when we're acting from fear. They just act differently to their fear than we do. So we're in judgment of how they act on their fear based on how we act on our fear. So we look at our own actions based on our fear, and we weigh them up against someone else's actions based on their fear. And so we make an arbitrary judgment that they're good or I'm good and they're bad. The way I react to my fear is a good way of reacting to the fear, and the way they react to the fear is a bad way. Mm-hmm. And but it's really, we're still both operating from the context of fear. We have to kind of push outside of that and beyond that and see that anyone in any role of trust that we've put there is going to react the way that the people around them react to things. So it's as much of a transformation of consciousness is where we're going anyways as a society, and what we're experiencing in the world is a shift in consciousness. Mm-hmm. That's why we're seeing things like the Occupy movement and things like that taking off the way that they're taking off, because people are waking up. Mm-hmm. So if people are waking up, then there is this transformation of consciousness happening, but how much are we ready to let go of all the fear? Because you still see it, you know. Mm-hmm. I commend those who have gone out and participated, because for the most part, what I've seen in my limited perspective of this movement is that for the most part, people are not resorting to violence. They're not resorting to conflict. However, there is still conflict within them. The way they look at, talk to, or react with, let's say, law enforcement, mm-hmm. is directly reflected back to them in how law enforcement acts towards them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clear that that we're not all in this place of coming from love and compassion and understanding, because if we were, there wouldn't be reflected back at us mm-hmm. what's being reflected back at us. You know, so like I've seen in the news around the Occupy movement, I've seen pregnant women have lost their children. I've seen people getting beaten and pepper sprayed and all these other things happening. But when you look at where people's hearts are in the movement, you're seeing that there's a lot of conflict there. There's a lot of blame there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear there. So as long as we take fear into it with us, that's what's going to be reflected back at us. So in reality, there is no role or person that has any power over us, that we've chosen to delegate this, and all we'll ever experience is a reflection of where we're at. So it's we're seeing it. I'm not pointing the finger and saying there's something wrong with what people are doing. I'm saying it's heading in the right direction, because people aren't being violent physically, but they're being violent in their thoughts. They're being violent mm-hmm. in their perception. They've brought into the situation their perception that police dressed a certain way, showing up in certain numbers, acting certain ways is a threat. That's how it occurs to them. So they act, think as if it is a threat. And so what we're seeing is just a reflection of this energy that we bring in. But what I think is going to happen is you're going to start to see a reversal of all this. That as people start to let go of the fear, then the police will let go of the fear. And people like George Bush will let go of the fear. And people mm-hmm. like the head of the pharmaceutical companies will let go of the fear. You know, but at the same time, we have to be aware that it's our fear that has built up everything where it's at. You know, pharmaceutical companies are just like any other part of our commercial system, are about making money. and we know that there's no money in cures. So of course they've suppressed cures to diseases. But guess what? It's all out there. You could cure cancer. You can get your hands on all the things you need to cure cancer. You can cure AIDS. You can get your hands on all the things you can to cure AIDS. Are they going to tell you on Channel 7 News how to cure AIDS? No.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to tell you on mainstream media how to cure cancer. But that doesn't mean that you're not responsible for finding the cure. It's out there. It's available.
Now, yeah, so one more thing. I agree with that 100%. I mean, I've known the cures for cancer, and they've been around since 1927 and before that in indigenous cultures. You know, it's a very simple process. Basically, most cancers are anaerobic. They hate oxygen, and all you have to do is raise the pH of your body or your blood and raise the oxygen levels, which are symbiotic, and it starts backing out of the system. And there's a lot of different ways. Otto Warburg, which is a triple PhD Nobel Peace Prize recipient, gave us that, you know, back in, I think, 1927. So, you know, that's just one case. But so basically what I'm getting is out of this is that basically there needs to be kind of a peaceful non-compliance. There needs to be some major education concerning the choices we do have, and basically as people, we're going to have to turn away from the media that is supporting the status quo and the corporations, which are capitalizing, you know, at the expense of humanity, the earth, and it's up to each individual to get educated and to make different alternative choices and to not. I would say not comply or cooperate with things that are harmful to humanity and the earth.
Right. And take a proactive approach to where we want to be. Like, for instance, we want, let's say, again, we go back to that system of values that we have, and one of the things we value is communication, right? Well, since we're not there yet, we don't have the infrastructure for a global transmission of information system, who do we go to? Well, let's look at the communication conglomerate, okay? So we've got AT&T, and we've got Verizon, and we've got these, you know, probably just a handful of corporations that run all of the interplanetary communication system, right? Or I should say international. I don't think it's an interplanetary system yet.
Well, that's already installed. That's already
there. Yeah, they're ready. So we take this international communication system, and where does Verizon get all of its power?
From the people buying their phones, basically.
Exactly. From the people buying phones and paying for the service. What if we got, let's say, 60% of the Verizon subscribers behind a consumer contractual deal, meaning we, 60% of your clients, decided that you're going to contract with us under these terms and conditions, and that if you don't, so you're going to lose 60% of your client base tomorrow. And we dictate that, for one, that the contract between Verizon and this 60% of its client base is going to be a contract drawn without the United States, meaning Verizon does not have limited liability protections in the contract, and we, the individuals, don't have the limited liability protections in the contract. It also means that if something about my Verizon service or device malfunctions and injures me, that I'm not going to use the public court system for remedy, that we have in our agreement with Verizon that some type of independent international adjudication or arbitration system will be used instead, okay? And so we could start to contract with all the many vendors of things in this way so that we're literally – we're getting them to a point where they don't have if they want to continue to benefit from us directing our energy towards them, then they're going to start to change the way they contract. And because we are the power base behind that company, we have the power to shape and move that corporation. Because if 60% of the subscribers, which probably equates to billions of dollars in annual revenue, say you're going to, you know, move the contract like this, or at least negotiate with them in such a way that we're now operating under a different context. We're no longer operating under the regulations of the United States that, you know, there's certain concessions that you, Verizon, must make in order to continue to benefit from us directing our energy towards you. And then take that out to everything. You know, what if everyone, what if 60% of the car buyers in this country said, you know, we're not going to buy our cars until and unless you start using these types of devices for motive power, meaning we're no longer going to stand for cars that run off of fuel, that every car should have a self-sustainable energy system within it. Mm-hmm. And see, literally, because that corporation would have to contract with us without the United States to be able to do that. Because the car companies are just as restricted in putting free energy devices in the cars as we are in buying them if we operate within the United States. But mm-hmm. if we free the car manufacturer from the restrictions of regulations within the United States, then they can put free energy devices in their cars. Or what if we said, well, we're going to build within our private society an adaptation device for vehicles to be used, and that we will enter into private contract to put these devices into people's cars so that they no longer have to fill their car with petroleum. Because there are devices out there, totally available, but the people who are behind these devices are trying to shove it through the public door. And they're not going to get anywhere with that. But part of their reasoning is because they also want to be able to maintain their protections. You know, they have certain protections the United States will offer them if they have a patent, right? Well, what if the concept, the idea, was not where you were making your money, but just in the implementation. Meaning anyone can implement the device, because I'm not looking for someone to protect my patent on the device. You know? So now I'm not forced to try to get a patent. I'm not forced to have my, I'm not trying to keep the technology away from anyone, but the money that I'm going to earn is going to be earned through implementation, installing the device, manufacturing the device. You know, these are the places where I'm going to make the money, not on the idea or the concept itself. And this, again, this is what, you know, that's actually one of the beautiful parts of a capitalistic system, is that competition end, where prices will be driven down by people doing it more effectively, more efficiently. That was the intention of capitalism, was to get the best possible product for the lowest possible price, you know, mm-hmm. and not to rape anything of its value or resources.
Mm-hmm. So we've lost that program. I know at once we were a republic, and then it became a democracy, and then now it's a corporate dictatorial democracy, and I don't know what it is now. I mean, we have this new bill that S-1867. I don't know if you want to comment on that, where they've decided that you know, they can snag anybody, anyone, anytime, anywhere, anytime, without trial. You know, again, where this is gone, you know, the only out on this is to operate outside of this program.
Right. And remember, it actually addresses U.S. citizens,
I
Right?
bet, you know,
But
a
they
lot of
now have
people
the
are
power to
probably
do
in
this to
fear
U.S.
about
citizens.
that. I mean,
What's that?
I'm sure that that is stirring up,
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
a lot of fear amongst people that are paying attention. And, you know, and some people might make the argument, well, yeah, that's all good if I, you know, say that I'm not a citizen, but how, you know, how, what difference is that going to make when the military comes, you know, if they did come, you know, knocking
Knocking
on
on your
your
door.
door and try and take you away? I'm sure that a lot of people would, that would be their perspective. So, I mean, what do you have to say about that,
Well,
Brandon?
the funny thing is that this is a huge wall they've hit with that bill. I don't know if you know the ramifications and how the Pentagon and forces like that reacted to the bill, but it basically, are politicians going to implement it? Meaning, do you think politicians are going to show up at people's houses and arrest them without warrants, without cause?
I wish they
No.
would.
So they're dependent on the forces of implementation. The forces
Sure.
of implementation of that bill are going to be the military, the police forces, the sheriff's department. Those are people. That is us. The military has already said, yeah, stick it up your ass. We're not going to do that to our citizens. Okay, so in military, the beautiful thing about the military is it's a top-down kind of organization. If the guy at the top says no, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. It doesn't matter if the politicians and the president and everyone else says yeah, because one of the things, and I actually, when I was a kid, I was in a youth military program. And one of the coolest things that stood out for me in being a part of that the principles of being a soldier are that you're to follow any lawful order, but you can disobey any unlawful order. And that really leaves a level of interpretation up to everyone. So people think it's a dictatorial system, meaning if the president tells the chiefs of staff or the general that he must do this, they think that he's got his hands tied, that there's nothing he can do, when in fact it's the general's discretion to decide, is this a lawful order? I have an oath to uphold the Constitution. Does this fit within that oath of upholding the Constitution? And like I said, the people at the Pentagon have already kind of laughed off this bill of arresting U.S. citizens and detaining them without trials and all that other stuff. They're not buying it. So unless the politicians are going to go out and try to implement, good luck. And again, that's because the military is actually dealing at a level, or at least the heads of the military, people in the Pentagon and things like that, are now aware. They're conscious of what's going on. And they're not going to blindly follow the destruction of this planet, or the destruction of this population, or this country. So they're moving in the direction of reason. Did you guys hear about the sheriff's department in, oh gosh, I want to say Wisconsin, that basically told the IRS that they better not do anything with any of the residents of Wisconsin, meaning they can't. I don't remember if it was Wisconsin, it was either Wisconsin, Montana, one of those, you know, northern states. And basically the sheriff said, we have the ultimate power of law enforcement in the county. So they basically denied the IRS, the FBI, any and all federal agencies from implementing any kind of warrants, from searching, from seizing, that they must go through the sheriff's. And the sheriffs have certain guidelines. They're not going to seize property unless there's a legitimate claim. And so they told all the federal agencies, get out and don't interact with our people. Come to us. That they basically started to recognize and remember that the sheriff's department was something that the people had established for law enforcement within the county, and they have the ultimate power of law enforcement within the county, not the IRS, not the FBI. Those are federal agencies that have no power at the county level. In reality, the only enforcement power they have are over entities that that are under their jurisdiction. Now let's look at the political subdivisions and how they work and the things that are under the United States and its controls and powers to regulate are business between the states. So if the state of Nevada enters into some kind of contract with the state of California, or if an entity authorized to do business under the state of California enters into a contract with an entity doing authorized to do business within the state of Nevada, then the feds can step in because this is interstate commerce and they have the power to regulate interstate commerce. But they do not. So you're looking at the death throes. You know, the system is obsolete. The system is falling apart. And this is their last attempt to grasping power. The idea that in every major city across this country, people are just obstructing commerce and speaking their mind and standing against corporations and government, that doesn't sit well with them. They go to and say fear. And because they're in a place of fear around it, they push through this ridiculous bill, which nobody's going to implement.
That's really inspiring to hear about that, you know, the sheriffs standing up and doing that. And I have the feeling that we're going to see a growing trend of that sort of stuff happening. So Brandon, in your Ben Lowry interview, I heard you mention that you'd read, you know, Wilcox Sourcefield investigation book. And, I was wondering if you were familiar with this recent story the narrative that Wilcox and Fulford were bringing out about this $1 trillion lawsuit that just got filed.
Oh yeah, that just got filed in New York.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I know that there's a lot of people that you know might be detractors of either of those fellows, but I'm interested in the story. Of this lawsuit, what can you tell us about your perspective on this and what you know about it?
I have a limited exposure to it. I saw the filing with the district court. What it appears to be to me is some time ago, during the right around the time of World War II. Well, first, let's put this into historical context. Gold is the foundational backing of our money system. It is a valuable commodity that's been the base of our economic system for thousands of years. Now, gold, it just so happens that during the Age of Conquest, from the Roman Empire up through the Spanish Armada and everything else, most of this gold that was being extracted from Africa and the Americas and anywhere in Asia and Europe was ending up in Asia, okay? 85% of the gold supply in the world ended up in China, okay? Because of the valuable silks, spices, and things that the ancient world saw as valuable, they spent all their gold on these products from the East. So during World War II was basically a gold grab that basically was an extraction of wealth. We saw here in the United States all the gold being confiscated, that it was outlawed, that you could not hold gold privately. And the same thing was happening in Europe. And the same thing was happening in Asia. Okay, you had Japan going around confiscating the gold of China and Korea and all the other Asian countries. And you had Germany extracting the gold of its population. You had America extracting gold of its population. Well, the Chinese, in an attempt to protect their assets, sent 7 battleship loads full of gold to the United States during World War II, okay? Now, that gold was sent, and in exchange, the United States Treasury posted bonds, Okay, these bonds today would be worth hundreds of trillions of dollars, okay, to the Chinese. And they were basically a 60-year, they were 60-year bonds, meaning after the bonds expired in 60 years, they would have to return all the gold to China, okay? And this gold was used to prop up the Federal Reserve system. So that was, I believe, around 1934, maybe 1939, somewhere around there, somewhere between 35 and 39. And so the 60 years expired around the mid-90s, end of the 90s. And China said, okay, give us back our gold. And the Federal Reserve basically reneged on the deal and refused to send the gold back. So the Chinese, or at least the families that held all this gold, because it's not necessarily the Chinese government that was in control of most of this wealth, that actually there are a small number of families in Asia that control most of that gold wealth. And so these families, in an attempt to basically get their valuable consideration, their gold back, used an elaborate sting operation on the international community. And what they did was they gave power of attorney to some individuals over just a couple of these bonds, like nowhere near the bonds that they actually hold. Like I said, their holdings would be worth probably hundreds of trillions of dollars in bonds. But they gave, I believe, what was it, $100 billion or was it a trillion? I think they gave the guy $1 trillion in bonds, okay? And this guy, I guess, got, I think he was crossing the border, I want to say.
Yeah, there's two
and
guys.
Some other country.
Yeah, there's two of them, and they're all dressed in those hats, something like out of the Bond movie, you know, with tuxedos and those funky hats, and they guess they grabbed both of them.
Yeah,
I heard conflicting reports, so they might have got let go as well.
Yeah, they let them go. Yeah. But they kept their bonds.
Yeah, they kept their bonds. And then they tried to cash the bonds. And so the Chinese, in their genius, because there are very few people who can actually cash those bonds, and very few people with knowledge of what it would take to cash those bonds. So the Chinese were basically able to track from the moment those bonds were confiscated, everyone who got their hands on them and everyone who illegally tried to cash them was basically brought in on this lawsuit. So you see in the lawsuit, named people like the head of the UN, a couple of Italian officials, I believe the prime minister of Italy or the former EU president. They named the United Nations itself. They name all these entities that in their criminal conspiracy were attempting to steal the Chinese money. And so now you've got, and now because they've been able to tag all these people with the transactions, now they've got this lawsuit going in New York for $1 trillion. Now, again, it's not for the $1 trillion itself. For one, they see our money as worthless. They don't want our money. They don't want any more Federal Reserve notes. But what they're trying to do is correct the financial system. The global financial system is deeply corrupt, deeply problematic, and there are forces around the world, around the planet, that for decades have been moving in a direction of creating a new system. Okay? And so this is just a piece of the plot, so to speak. This is just a part of the plan in implementing a new global financial system that does not operate in the destructive way the old system operates. So that's pretty much a synopsis of what I know about what's going on and what's, and to me, the purpose, the reasoning behind it all.
This is another like amazing piece of like the just growing trend that we're seeing around the planet, man. I mean, do you foresee that this has, you know, the capacity to be successful?
Oh yeah, absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, it's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. People's consciousness is transforming. So the world itself is transforming. The people in positions of power and control, they're transforming. So you're starting to see where everyone, you know, for the old system to operate effectively, because there's so much suppression and corruption, it's governed through fear. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as people start to break out of this fear and they're no longer driven by fear, you're starting to see these radical things like this $1 trillion lawsuit, like all the things that we're seeing, the Occupy movement, and people are pushing through their fear because mm-hmm. their consciousness is moving forward. Their consciousness is evolving, so they can no longer just sit in fear of what's around them. They feel motivated to stand up. They feel motivated to take a stand for something sustainable, to take a stand for something reasonable. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing in all facets of our global society. You know, you're seeing this transformation where the old good old boys network is become completely dysfunctional. It's mm-hmm. no longer a nepotistic, corrupt, you know, system. It's moving into being what it was intended to originally be when we originally authored this system into existence. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is basically the world coming back to the intention of the people. As the people's intention starts to get clear and focused, because it's when you let go of that fear that you're able to go, okay, well, what do we want? What do we want to create? What do we want to invent? Now that we're not driven by fear anymore, where do we want to go? Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. why you have these wealthy families in Asia doing what they're doing. And that's why you have people like Fulford and mm-hmm. Wilcox doing what they're doing. You know, it's why I do what I do, because uh-huh. my consciousness is at a place where I feel motivated. I feel moved to take a stand. I feel moved to do what I'm doing and to say what I'm saying, because I'm no longer letting fear mm-hmm. govern my decisions, my choices. And you're seeing that worldwide, where people are letting go of fear and no longer letting that be the determining factor in what they choose. Mm-hmm.
This, I've got, you know, to me, this thing seems like the Chinese, and, you know, they're very wise. They've been around a long time and they know how to do business, and they're very patient. But this looks like a $1 trillion rat trap to me.
It is. It's totally a $1 trillion rat trap. And they fell for it. And so they fell for the trap, and now they're going to pay the price. Now, whether or not the litigation works out, because I could see this going several ways.
Yeah.
You know, it could also be an opportunity to expose the corruption of our judicial system.
Exactly.
You know, how are the judges going to react to this? You know, I think this rat trap is going to weed out a lot more than they intended. I think it's going to have a much bigger ramification than just transforming the economic system. I think it has the potential of transforming not only the economic system, but the political system and the judicial systems as well.
And the media, everything. It's going to embarrass all of them.
Yep. It's really gonna. It's gonna hit home in a lot of places, and I think we're already starting to see it. Like, I've noticed. Now, I wasn't born and raised here. I was born and raised. I'm in New Mexico right now. I was born and raised in Southern California, and my experience of the media in Southern California is it's very much corporate controlled. Mm-hmm. Now, here in New Mexico, I don't get that I get that there's still a lot of corporate influence, but I don't get that it's as corrupt as the system of Southern California. Because I see here, when I see, you know, the news reports and things like that, I'm often shocked at what these news reporters out here will talk about. Like, it kind of blows me away. Like, literally, I watched a news channel or, you know, the local news blasting Verizon. And the best part about it was that Verizon was one of their sponsors. So they don't... They weren't even afraid of, like, losing Verizon as a sponsor. They were like, just here, we're going to report this. You know, Verizon's doing something wrong, and we're going to report it. And we're going to – and they literally got Verizon to apologize. They got Verizon to do all these things with the consumers here in New Mexico that I couldn't imagine ever seeing anything like this happen in Los Angeles. Where in Los Angeles, the corporations, they make the call. You're gonna show this on the news. Of course, you're not gonna show anything that casts a shadow on us. We're your advertisers. We pay you millions, if not billions, of dollars. And here in Albuquerque, they're like, yeah, they're one of our advertisers, but hey, this is a newsworthy story, and they're hurting our consumers. And so they literally, I've seen news reports that, from all my perception, seem to actually be geared for the consumers, for the population of New Mexico. They're not concerned about Verizon. They're more concerned about the people of New Mexico. And that, to me, is amazing. I mean, it shouldn't be amazing. It should be the standard. It should be what all news reporting is based on. It should be fact and should be protection of the population. So for me, when I see it, it's shocking, because I haven't actually witnessed that in major media in a long time. And I've started to even see things like on Fox. Like, Fox News Channel has actually let a couple things into their news reporting that I'm surprised by, that really doesn't fully support the agenda of big corporations controlling. You know, so I've seen some surprising things, and more often lately than in the past. So to me, this transformation of consciousness is being reflected back in major media, and it's being reflected in people turning to alternative media. Mm-hmm. You know, many people turn to alternative media now and accept it as useful, as beneficial, as something that they can base their choices and decisions on. You know, that it's clear to people, it's becoming clearer and clearer to people that major media is being driven by a certain agenda, and that that agenda doesn't necessarily always have our interests in its heart. And people are recognizing that. So people can still watch the major media, and what they're starting to see is they're starting to see right through it. Like the whole Ron Paul thing. You don't think people notice that you're not putting his name up? You don't think that people don't notice that you have on the website he's ahead of the poll, and then all of a sudden he's removed from the news report? Like, these are things people are noticing. You know, people are noticing that, wait a minute, there's an agenda being perpetrated here by the media.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how different it is, like, this year in comparison to, like, 4 years ago, the last election. Mm-hmm. So, Brandon, you know, we got about 10 minutes left here. It's going to be time to wrap things up. I was wondering if you had any recent success stories that either you personally or some of the people that you might have been coaching or some of the other folks, you know, affiliated with the Creditors and Commerce, have to report on.
Well, there's always so much going on. As far as I know, people are actually what I've been seeing is that there's, again, this transformation in consciousness. We've experienced, like, people taking their private remedy and bringing, you know, if, let's see, now I'm going to, I don't know if I could do this in 10 minutes. I don't want to have to try to explain the whole philosophy behind private administrative process, but to put it simply, you know, a lot of times when you perfect a private contract and you've come about a private remedy, typically to get, if you need any kind of enforcement, meaning like, let's say your private process is against a bank for a credit card debt. And now, and you've basically come through your private process to settlement, mm-hmm. meaning you've gotten, you know, some kind of an agreement, maybe with the CFO or something else, that the account balance is zero, that there is no outstanding obligation or liability, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then let's say that someone sues you for that account. Now, I say someone because typically what we see is attorneys buy up these accounts even though they've been charged off, meaning they've been set off. There mm-hmm. is no debtor obligation. And then they go around suing the cardholders, mm-hmm. okay, in court for the amounts. We've actually been seeing a lot of these cases being overturned in the courts based on our private process and based on our own diligence. You know, like we're not opposed to using the public system, but we like to keep it, we like to limit our exposure to the public judicial system expressly for enforcement against an entity within the United States. So when I'm in a private contract with, let's say, the bank, that contract is outside the United States. And I come to a judgment outside the United States on my private process, I'm now going to bring it into a court within the United States for enforcement. And I would do the same if I were, let's say, my company, ABC Inc., was doing business with a Russian company. And I screwed the Russian company out of some widgets, and now they're looking for compensation for their lost widgets. They could go to a Russian court, get their judgment, that's a foreign court to the United States, and then they could bring their judgment here, get it ratified, and then bring their judgment here, register it, and then enforce it on the entity that's here in the United States. And there's certain standards and things like that that international adjudication and arbitration must meet in order to be recognized globally. And we started to do that, and we started to see positive remedy, and we're starting to see the judges. Well, I've been seeing it for years, but I'm actually getting reports back from people that when they're in court, the judges are leaning towards the private. You know, they're leaning towards assisting those who have done their private process. And we've seen people getting successes from just being, like, coming from the right place. You know, mm-hmm. again, we talked about the come from.
Yeah.
We've been seeing people getting a lot of positive results with, like, credit card things and mortgage deals and things like that, where the judges aren't as quickly to renounce or denounce, I should say, your process. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really starting to lean towards recognition of what you're doing. And that, to me, is just a sign of the times, that this mm-hmm. transformation in consciousness is playing out in all venues. You know, in the courts as well as in the international political and economic scene, we're seeing that, and not to say that you need to know what I know or to do what I do to get your remedy, because we've seen people just walking into courts with just a public process, meaning nothing other than the court pleadings and their mm-hmm. own pleadings. Uh-huh. But what they're doing is they're approaching it logically. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not approaching it emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, rather than going in there and being angry and upset that, you know, the card got charged off, therefore set off, and now you're being sued by someone who doesn't even work for the company or or is representing the company to get the money from you, rather than reacting emotionally, people are being able more able to stand and be objective and get their remedy just from literally asking the right question. In fact, one of my assistants did that recently, where he it's when you send them a series of questions.
Debt verification process.
It's just a typical public court process. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that you don't remember what it's called, but it's when you just send a series of questions, and this is something that happens in court all the time. And you basically question the nature of the debt, mm-hmm. the nature of the transactions, evidence of the debt, evidence of verification of the debt, and things like that, and went into court with, just public pleadings, and basically got the credit card company. Now, at least that's what they were representing themselves to be. It was actually just an attorney pretending to represent the credit card company, but he actually just owned the collection service.
Yeah.
And the attorney dismissed the case because he couldn't, for one, if he were to answer the questions, he'd be admitting to committing a crime.
Yeah.
So rather than answering them, by not answering them truthfully, he just dismissed the case so that he wouldn't have to answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And so this wasn't a private process by its nature. It was a fully public process. You know, the credit card company sued, so there was a summons and a complaint for money, and this gentleman put in an answer and into the public court. It wasn't during the private contract process, and basically just asking them a series of questions, And by them not being able to answer those questions, they dismiss the case. And I think we're going to start to see a lot more of that, as people start to understand the nature of the creation of money and debt.
Yeah.
There isn't anything anyone should be losing property on, or having liens or anything else put against them when you consider the nature of money, how it's created, and the nature of debt. So, and that knowledge has been around now for mm-hmm. so many years. Did I mention it last? I don't remember if this was on the Ben Lowry show or if the last time mm-hmm. I was on your show, but the Irish government did a debt validation process. They did it on the international bank. So they're basically saying, yeah, okay, show me proof that you lent me something of value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because they didn't. All they did, they did the same thing. The International Monetary Fund does the same thing when a country borrows money that the local bank does when you borrow money to buy a house. Mm-hmm. All they did was enter some numbers on a computer screen. That's it. And so that's all the International Monetary Fund does too. And so when the Irish government stands up and says, wait, what did you give us? Show me the valuable consideration. The International Monetary Fund has nothing to show mm-hmm. because they never gave them anything of value. Mm-hmm. All they did was enter some numbers into a computer screen. And so if it's happening at the international level, meaning national governments are doing debt validation, I think that that's speaking to where we're at consciously. Mm-hmm. Again, talking about the expansion of consciousness, just 2 years ago, this was considered fringe information. This wasn't common knowledge. It was, in fact, not only was it not common knowledge, it was wacky. That how absurd for you to think that they did not loan you money, And yeah. Now we have governments of countries going, wait a minute, you didn't actually loan us anything. We're challenging this.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon,
we're coming up to the end of the hour here. We just got some short time left, but How can people, you know, get a hold of those series of questions to ask and get educated into how to claim their sovereignty and understand the system? What is their best avenue? Maybe you can give us some help in that direction.
Well, education. Education is the number one thing. And so coming to an understanding of how money's created, how government operates, the nature, the contractual nature of everything. You know, there's nothing in human interaction that is not contract. I would say one a good place to start may be Mel Stamper has a book called Fruits from a Forbidden Tree or something like that, or look up the author Mel Stamper, and he has a book, it's something about a poisonous tree or fruits from a forbidden tree, poisonous tree, something like that. And it's a great synopsis of, for one, how we got from a republic to where we are now. And it breaks down money. It breaks down the, it does a very good job of articulating what the contents of the Federal Reserve modern money mechanics, because that's the tool I used, and it's the tool I used in my classes to try to educate people on the nature of money. But it's written from a financier's point of view. So most people, most laymen, don't understand what's being said in it. And Mel kind of takes and articulates it. He regurgitates it in such a way that it's that people get it and can understand it.
Yeah, what I was asking is how can they get a hold of you? How can they get a hold of you and like your website and you know, to take some of your classes or get involved in whatever you have to offer? What's the best way for them to you know, to get some help with these issues?
Well, right now we're starting, and now I do exclusively, extended programs. We have a 6-month training course. And our next one actually is just about to start. It starts January 6th. And if you wanted to register for that, it's basically, it's called Mastery in Commerce, and it's a 6-month training where we lay out the foundation of commerce and how everything operates, so that people can be effective. Now, the purpose of it is mainly we're looking for people who want to take this knowledge and assist people, support people in their community. You know, if you've got an emergency situation, you're going to lose your house tomorrow, a 6-month educational program isn't the solution, you know. But if you're truly looking to understand these things at a level where you could support yourself, your community, your family, and your friends with this information, then this would be the course for you. And I believe you can get information about it at masteryincommerce.org. I'm going to type that in real quick and see if that is true.
And the other, the main website is Creditors in Commerce, right?
Yeah. Creditorsandcommerce.com.
Man, there's all sorts of awesome stuff on there. Yeah.
What's that?
I was just saying, there's all sorts of awesome, you know, free audio and video that you guys have on there. And so, yeah, it's definitely well recommended. Brandon, it looks like this is about it for the time for today's program. Could we keep you on the line just for another minute, though, privately to talk afterwards? Just for a sec.
Yeah, no problem.
Cool.
All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Brandon, and keep up the great work.
All right. Thanks, guys.